11th hour, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for March 25th, 2018, a special post-primary election edition of the Sunday Spin. Thanks, as always, for joining us this morning for our weekly look at the world of politics and policy. We'll take you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. And speaking of hot, how about those Loyola Ramblers? Wow. I mean, just wow. Andy, after those previous games and the one-pointers, you know, you can't ever really sit back and relax and enjoy a game that you're really intensely watching. But you said you knew early on.
I was good, yeah.
Tell me what I missed here. I mean,
stifling defense.
Yes.
Defense turning into offense. And that's Porter Moser's calling card. You get that stifling group defense, and it usually leads to easy shots. We've seen that a couple of times when they've really needed it in the previous three games. But, you know, this was a clinic. I mean, this was an absolute clinic.
Well, I'm a fan of three-pointers, except I hate to see a team that relies on them. Mm-hmm. And I kept going back and forth. It's like, oh, no, you're shooting another three. And then they'd make it and go, dagger, you know?
Exactly. That's one of those, no, great shot.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing I was concerned about was turnovers.
Yeah.
And actually, Kansas State, they made the most of those turnovers. And I don't know, going forward, that you can afford to do that.
No, you probably can't. I mean, in the first half alone, it was half of Kansas State's points were scored off of Loyola's turnovers. They had 24 points at the half, and 12 came on Ramblers' turnovers. You know, some of that obviously had to do with early game jitters and just the I think the nerves of the big stage. And I think they really kind of they cleaned it up a little bit toward the end. I'm going to check real quick. I have the box score up here. Ended up being 15 turnovers. So it seemed like a lot more early.
Yeah.
They cleaned things up later, and that was really important.
Yeah. But I'm not sure there's a great margin of error here against Michigan.
No, probably not. I mean, and you know, they face challenges with each of the teams that they've faced and now that they're about to face. You know, you kind of get caught up looking at some of the jerseys and, you know, with Miami coming in as a really big and physical team. Tennessee had that same reputation. Nevada was a team that played supposedly stifling defense and could score from all over. And obviously last night Kansas State had a reputation of playing tremendous defense, and the Ramblers just scored 78 points.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't seem to care, you know what I mean?
Right. And I will say, you know, I figured moving into the bigger stage of the Elite Eight that it would be more of a tentative kind of game, and it wasn't.
No, I mean, this is an experienced team. I mean, you look at the starting lineup. You've got Dante Ingram, who's a senior. You got Marcus Towns, who transferred in as a senior. He's been to the NCAA tournament before with Fairleigh Dickinson. You know, Clayton Custer is a senior in class, but a junior as far as eligibility is concerned after transferring in. And Ben Richardson is also a senior. So I mean, you've got guys that have been through the battles before. They were there when Porter Moser was first starting to, you know, instill this culture.
Right.
And they were the important ones to kind of buy in, because now they're blazing a trail for the younger guys who are actually getting some chances to play here.
Well, I put on social media that, you know, in this city with all of kind of the strife and even sometimes hate, particularly coming off a brutal election, primary election season, this is one thing that we can all unite behind and root for. You know, it's just something that we can all take in and enjoy and be for something, rather than always being against something.
Yeah, and don't be embarrassed to say that you've jumped on the bandwagon, because, you know,
I have.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that have jumped on the bandwagon, and, you know, they're all fine with that, to be honest with you. They say the more the merrier. You just go ahead and support and support. I mean, we saw this happen last year with Northwestern and their run and their first ever trip to the NCAA tournament and a win in their first round game over Vanderbilt. So we're kind of used to seeing lesser known programs. I guess, you know, Northwestern is not a lesser known program. I guess neither is Loyola. But, you know, when you get to the college level here, we're thought of as such a pro town because of all the five major sports teams that we have here, that it's really hard for some college teams to get any notoriety unless they do this. So, hey, I'm glad they're doing this, and I'm glad the city's behind them.
And what I'd like to is, coming from the Valley Conference, you know, these are the kind of conferences that always get overlooked on the bigger national stage.
Yeah. I mean, this is considered basically it used to be when Wichita State and Creighton were in it, it used to be a two-bid league. But then when they left...
Even Bradley back in the day.
Absolutely. I remember those days very fondly as I was a Bradley student. it's actually something that is kind of serving as a platform for a lot of folks on social media, as you point out, that... You know, the Valley has sent, I believe, more teams now to the Final Four in the last 5 years than the Power Fives. So it's one of those kind of things where I don't know if it will ever change, but it certainly is a message, I think, to the selection committee and what they base things on. Because you got to be honest with yourselves. Mid-major teams have such a difficult time scheduling games as it is. Their RPIs are going to be low because of that. And they can't get a big team to come in to play them in their building because the other team's afraid to lose.
Exactly.
And they don't want to hurt their own recruiting.
And they don't want the economic issue involved. I mean, let's not forget that aspect of it.
So it's difficult. I mean, I feel for these mid-major coaches. I've been around mid-major programs my entire broadcasting career, and I get it. I mean, I watch these coaches painstakingly try to put schedules together to compete on a national level, and it's very difficult for them to do.
Yeah, it's. But let's just take this all in.
Enjoy it. Think about the political aspect of sports in this case.
Right. Let's just take this all in and enjoy it for the moment, and let's hope the moment continues.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just so great.
And how likable is this group?
That's the thing.
I mean, so likable.
You know, and Sister Jean. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole national aspect of that.
Yep. I was about to comment about Sister Jean. I will vote for her for president.
Well, I did like in one interview, she was asked what she gave up for Lent, and her answer was losing.
Yeah, bless her heart.
I mean,
something else.
Yeah, how can you, County Clerk David Orr on Twitter posted one of his scrapbooks where he was a professor and as well as a basketball coach at Mundelein College when Sister Jean was dean of Mundelein College, the forerunner to Loyola. I mean, just these little stories that are, you know, in the background here are just fantastic and woven into part of the city. And like I said, let's just all enjoy this for what it is. Glad the Blackhawks were able to get a win, although it's almost like Blackhawks are asterisks right now in the sports world.
Yep.
Putting Patrick Keane in at center for trying something new.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That went okay.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, he scored a goal and a little underwhelming in the faceoff.
Yeah.
But, you know, that comes with being a right winger going in there and trying to play center in an NHL game. It's not as easy, perhaps, as it looks and as it sounds. But, you know, it's nice to get some wins toward the end of the year here just to kind of feel good about things. And, you know, why not experiment on some other things as well? Because, you know, Patrick Kane's going to be around.
Right.
Obviously, Jonathan Toews is banged up a little bit. But why risk anything further with him when the games don't really mean as much? I mean, obviously, it means something to the fans who pay their money to go see the Hawks at the United Center, which they'll have an opportunity to do that tomorrow. But, you have to kind of find out what you have.
Well, yeah, and this is a time to experiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing to lose. right
now. That's true. That's true.
So why not do some experimentation? And I mean, it's not like Coach Q doesn't shake up the lines. Sure. I mean, that's
the blender.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But yeah, let's experiment. Let's see. And it's going to be a very interesting off season over there on Madison Street.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, I think there's a couple of guys auditioning for a backup goaltender role, and there's still some things to watch.
Absolutely. Well, we've got Andy here with all of the sports. We've got the Shamrock Shuffle going on today, so beware of that if you're traveling downtown. Plenty of street closures, and obviously Dave will have all the information on what's going on with that as
it's
well.
It's starting at 8, so if you don't have to be down in that area, maybe it's just best to watch on TV.
There you go.
Or listen to us, better yet.
There you go. 720. Even better. Producer Casera is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can find us at Facebook at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is still in with his brackets. I'll give him credit with that. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, after the 7:30 news break, we'll have a special 90-minute roundtable on the results of the primary elections and what's ahead for the fall campaigns. Back from last week are my good friends Bob Sector from the Better Government Association and Christopher Mooney from the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. That's all ahead, but right now we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time.
That's the great Ella Fitzgerald singing Stormy Weather. And I'm not talking about rain in the forecast on Tuesday here in Chicago. There's a bit of a stormy event going on 60 Minutes tonight on CBS. Time for our weekly spin through national politics. And yesterday, a historic groundswell of youth activism. Hundreds of thousands of teens, their supporters, rallied across the United States and around the world against gun violence, vowing to transform fear and grief into a vote them out movement and tougher laws against weapons and ammunition. Voter registration drives. They took to the streets in Chicago, New York, Boston, Houston, Paris, Hong Kong, Washington, D.C. Some of the young voices were very young. Yolanda Renee King, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s 9-year-old granddaughter, drew from the civil rights leader's most famous words in declaring from the stage, quote, "I have a dream that enough is enough," end quote. The NRA, the National Rifle Association, in response on Facebook, posted a short membership drive video along with a brief message, "Stand and fight for our kids' safety by joining the NRA. Today's protests aren't spontaneous. Gun-hating billionaires and Hollywood elites are manipulating and exploiting children as part of their plan to destroy the Second Amendment and strip us of our right to defend ourselves and our loved ones." That was the message from the NRA. Well, another crazy Trump-driven week in Washington, D.C. He's already tweeting this morning, "Many lawyers and top law firms want to represent me in the Russia case. Don't believe the fake news narrative that is hard to find a lawyer who wants to take this on. Fame and fortune will never be turned down by a lawyer, though some are conflicted. Problem is that a new lawyer or law firm will take months to get up to speed, if for no other reason than they can bill more, which is unfair to our great country, and I'm very happy with my existing team. Besides, there was no collusion with Russia except by crooked Hillary and the Dems." That's the word out of Mar-a-Lago Florida this morning.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Another crazy Trump-driven week in Washington. He dumps one of his top lawyers in the Robert Mueller probe, despite the fact that he tweeted out this morning he's very happy with his legal team. He says former Vice President Joe Biden would, quote, go down fast and hard and crying all the way, unquote, if the two men exchanged punches. He fires his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster. He imposes tariffs on China that send the stock market reeling downward. And tonight he'll get to see Stormy Daniels detail their alleged affair on 60 Minutes and talk about threats and hush money. Where do you begin? How about Trump signing a budget bill to keep government open after threatening to veto the bill after the White House originally said he would sign it? Confused? So is everyone on Capitol Hill. Here's the president.
As a matter of national security, I've signed this omnibus budget bill. There are a lot of things that I'm unhappy about in this bill. There are a lot of things that we shouldn't have had in this bill, but we were, in a sense, forced, if we want to build our military, we were forced to have. There are some things that we should have in the bill. But I say to Congress, I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again.
Remember those words. Just remember those words. Now, Trump, as I said, also got rid of White House National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and replaced him with former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton. Turns out Bolton's super PAC was a customer of that Cambridge Analytics, the same firm that's in hot water for its use of Facebook data for the Trump campaign. But perhaps even stranger still was Bolton's work on behalf of the National Rifle Association, an effort to bring a right-to-bear-arms campaign to Russia. Here's Bolton speaking from a 2013 video to the Russian people.
Thank you for this opportunity to address the Russian people on the 20th anniversary of the adoption of the Russian Constitution. This document signaled a new era of freedom for the Russian people and created a new force for democracy in the world. While more time has passed since the United States created our own constitutional freedoms, we never forget the joyful optimism that marked the beginning of our democratic history. We wish our Russian friends that same hope and pray for you the strength to preserve these first precious freedoms.
That's our national security advisor talking about all of the freedoms that exist in Russia, John Bolton. Joining me now here in the studio is Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and Christopher Mooney, a political scientist with the University of Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me for this special post-primary edition of the Sunday Spin. But if you have any comments about John Bolton, you're more than welcome to join in.
My head hurts. That's all I can say.
I notice he stood up to Trump, though, in the sense that he still has the mustache, which Trump has expressed his pleasure with. So that shows that he's a man of his own conscience.
Well, wait a minute. Ty Cobb has an even bigger mustache. So
but he's getting rid of Ty Cobb, apparently.
When you're Ty Cobb, you can do whatever you want.
Well, gentlemen, I wanted to have you in after last week and kindness that you showed talking about the pre-primary. Well, now it's post-primary. We've seen the ballots have been cast. And before we begin, I've got a text from a teacher talking about yesterday's March for Our Lives and the youth movement there, and that traditionally younger voters don't turn out. Every election we hear is going to be the year, and it doesn't hurt. And so this is a kind of a rhetorical question, but why should any politician listen to anyone under 30 when they don't vote? And they don't vote, and here's a cause that they're uniting behind, but if they don't vote, nothing will change.
Well, yeah, I mean, age is negatively correlated with voter turnout, right? So the older people get, it's a very steady path. The older you are, the more likely you are to vote until you get into your late 70s, and then it kind of takes a little bit of a right turn. And, you know, political scientists, I mean, mostly what we explain is it comes down to practice, right? I mean, it's a little
complicated.
Yeah, it's a habit. It's a little bit complicated to vote. You know, you've got to figure out how to register. You've got to find out when they're open. You got to go down at a particular time. Now with early voting, it makes it easier, and people are really taking advantage of it. We saw that on Tuesday quite a bit. Well, previous to Tuesday. But the thing is that it's not that young people are apathetic. It's not, or any more so than anybody else, or that they're stupid. It's just that they haven't had the chance to go through that process. And you know, they will, and will they turn out now because they're, you know, enthusiastic about gun violence? I doubt it. I mean, we were expecting to turn out for Obama, and they didn't really do it. You know, the Vietnam War didn't really generate a lot of turnout. Our turnout went down like crazy when we allowed 18-year-olds to start voting again. So it's just a large social force. It's not a particular issue at play.
It also might be geographic, too. I mean, you know, here in Illinois, we're a Democratic state, people in general, at least in the Chicago area, tend to be more liberal. You might get an energized force to go out, but is that going to happen in Florida or in Texas or in Utah? I don't know.
I mean, obviously, you can see in college towns that you have a higher turnout, but it's a more concentrated kind of culture.
Yeah, and you see in the Republican voter suppression efforts, one of the things they target is college towns, trying to craft rules to make it more difficult for college students to vote if they don't live
because of the transient
right
nature of.
And I believe that when Chris Kobach had his Kansas Secretary of State had his voter commission
integrity commission
integrity.
The Trump formed voter integrity no longer exists
voter integrity no longer exists or the commission
the commission
oh, okay. But one of the things he was alleging was that in New Hampshire they had thousands and thousands of suspect votes, and what that really was people at Dartmouth voting, and who may have lived in Massachusetts, but under the rules they were allowed to vote in New Hampshire, and somehow that was targeted as illegal voting.
We'll see if something's different this time. I mean, you know, that was one factor that I wondered about in this election, is given the protests that occurred following Trump's election as president, and there was a youth component to that. The Bernie Sanders was a youth component to that, and whether that would translate into the primaries here, and we really didn't see it.
I don't think we know that we've seen it yet. I haven't seen any data on exit polls on age groups. Have you seen that?
I've seen some references. I've not seen a full-fledged exit poll. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to be that it was not in significant numbers.
Yeah, and that makes sense. You know, the other thing you want to think about in terms of protesting, I mean, the Women's March was every bit as big, and these are people who are probably more sophisticated politically in general. They're going to be older, so they're more likely to vote, and so it's, you know, that may be, you know, the motivation on that end, and so is that, which I suppose are primarily Democrats involved in that to some extent, or at least the extent that it's anti-Trump, or maybe moderate Republicans. And so are these people going to be more likely to show up in November? They didn't really seem to show up yet on Tuesday so much. For example, Dan Lipinski in the 3rd Congressional District is a conservative Democrat, one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress, one of those few remaining middle-of-the-road kind of people in the U.S. House of Representatives, had a very, very strong challenge from the left by Marie Newman, and she almost beat him, which is is pretty unheard to lose, for an incumbent to lose a primary for the House of Representatives when, you know, absent scandal. That's a rare thing to happen, and she almost pulled it off.
Well, let's talk about that race. So we have Dan Lipinski wins renomination, essentially re-election in a heavily Democratic congressional district.
Well, he's got to be that Nazi guy in November, so
yeah,
we'll see how that goes.
So in the suburbs, the southwest side, southwest suburban district, 51%, 49% in that race. And one of the questions I had, and speaking to both of them, is whether that district had changed from Lipinski being seven terms, and was that district still kind of a blue dog district, or did the demographics change to make it a more liberal district? And whether Newman's challenge, fueled in part by outside organizations, you know, did that really say what was going on in the district? And, I mean, a narrow victory here.
Well,
a
victory, but the fact that she got 49% of the vote suggests change. Clearly not enough change to take the district yet, but, you know, 3 years ago, four years ago, or that might not have happened. And so if I were Mr. Lipinski, this might, you know, you may want to think about 2020 and say, well, maybe next time it's time to retire.
Okay. Well, and also we'll be coming up to map redrawing after the 2020 census too, and Illinois is going to lose at least one seat, if not more, and that also could be a factor too in drawing the districts. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Chuy García easily won to replace Luis Gutierrez in the 4th district. 6th district, which is the Peter Roskam district. Sean Caston wins that one. There were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least 5 women that were running there. So kind of a case of the opposite. It's normally how we see males splitting the vote, allowing a woman to win a nomination. But Sean Caston now taking on Peter Roskam, Sean Caston, the Democrat. And this is going to be a nationally watched congressional race.
Yeah, I think Roskam, in fact, lucked out by drawing the male opponent, because I think a female opponent would have been all things equal, a female opponent would have been more difficult for him, given who he's, you know, we always say that, you know, the swing voter statewide elections is the soccer mom in Schaumburg, or something like that, or maybe it's
moderate suburban women.
Moderate suburban women. They're fiscally conservative, but they're socially liberal, and that's his district in spades, right? I think he's from Schaumburg, right? No, not Schaumburg.
He's Wheaton.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, that's a little more conservative if you go down in that direction, but still, he's been hammered nationally and locally for not doing. He was blind. This is a class. This happens to House members sometimes. You know, they're in there for a while. He's cruising along. He was in a state house. He went to Congress. He's cruising along. He gets on appropriations. He starts looking in leadership. Everything's going very well for him.
Ways and means.
Oh, ways and means, right. Not appropriations. And then something happens. Some wild card gets thrown at him. In this case, it's Donald Trump, in a sense. And, you know, now the question is, can he, and again, this happens to every member of Congress probably who's been in for many years. At one or two times in their career, they've had a serious challenge. And if they can survive that, then they can, you know, then they become the more senior members and so forth.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. We're speaking to Bob Sector from the PGA and Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois, going over the primary results. And before the break, we were talking about that West Suburban, Northwest Suburban 6th Congressional District, Peter Roskam and now Sean Caston, the Democratic nominee. Well, let's remember, too, that this was a district that voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. And in fact, I think a factor that I kind of keep repeating is that the collar counties, except for McHenry County, voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. But you have Roskam, he basically was in charge of the tax policy subcommittee of House Ways and Means, and he was in charge of writing the tax bill that the Republicans passed.
Yeah, and that tax bill is, while it's great for states that went for Trump, it's not very good for Illinois, and especially in a district like Roskam's. Now, on the flip side, the advantage Roskam has is that most of his constituents won't actually be filling out their tax returns that will impact, or where that tax bill will impact them, until after the election. So they won't really understand what his handiwork has done to them.
I have a feeling that the Democrats are going to do their best to inform them of that.
Well, and I assume specifically you're talking about the issue of the capping the
deductibility,
state and local tax issue.
Correct. And you have as we know endlessly, we have very high property taxes in Illinois, and I'm sure in his district they do. And those taxes will no longer be deductible for most of his constituents.
$10,000 worth will be
right, but that probably will be probably result in a negative for many of those constituents. They'll probably end up having to either take the standard deduction, which may or may not be good for them, but in likelihood they'll actually lose.
Well, that's, I mean, as I said, this will be perhaps one of the most watched congressional races around the nation.
In fact, we've got a few in this. There's probably four districts in this state that could go from Republican to Democrat, you know, depending on how things go.
I think the Roskam district is the one that's most demonstrably a district that had gone, you know, based on 2016 for Hillary. But yeah, I mean, you've got the Mike Bost district is being watched down in kind of the Metro East area there.
The 13th with Rodney Davis between Urbana-Springfield and the Metro East is possible. I mean, it was drawn that way. Rodney Davis is a great incumbent, so he's hard to beat. You know, potentially one of the other suburban districts too. I mean, it's
right. Randy Hultgren. Now his district, his district did go slightly Trump there.
Yeah, but you know, it's going to be a weird year. You know, the tax bill is going to be played up by the Democrats in the suburbs, no doubt. And you know, Trump, it's hard to know. You know, what's going to happen with how people are reacting with him 6 months from now? I mean, who would have figured? You can't guess. You can't make it up. You can't guess what's going to happen. You know, maybe come November, he'll be wearing a bozo costume and orange hair, and we'll all think that's normal, too. So, who knows?
Chris Mooney from the U of I, Bob Sector from the PGA. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue is Bob Sector, the Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and Christopher Mooney, political scientist from the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And, gentlemen, I want to play a clip that might be the best answer to how not to explain things to a congressional committee. Ben Carson was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, was asked about a $31,000 table that had been ordered for the cabinet secretary's dining room. This is how he responded.
I left it with my wife. I said, you know, help choose something. The next thing that I quite frankly heard about it was that this $31,000 table had been bought. I said, what the heck is that all about? Investigated, immediately had it canceled. Not that we don't need the furniture, but I thought that that was excessive. There were reports that, you know, I said that I had no involvement. I always said what my involvement was in it.
Yeah, it was having the wife do it. Meanwhile, former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said goodbye for the last time to the State Department employees, part of the rolling turnover on Team Trump. Tillerson asked the workers to do him a favor because of the atmosphere in Washington.
I'd like to ask that each of you undertake to ensure one act of kindness each day towards another person. This can be a very mean-spirited town. But you don't have to choose to participate in that.
And there goes Rex Tillerson. Well, we've been talking about the results of the Illinois primary election, and I wanted to talk right now about the county, Cook County races. And obviously the big changeover, Joe Berrios, the Cook County assessor, the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party, losing to Fritz Kagi, 46% to 34%, with Andrea Rala somewhere in the 20s, but we can't really be sure because she was off the ballot, then on the ballot, then off the ballot, and then some precincts were told she was off the ballot when she was on the ballot.
Election hokey pokey.
Yes, yes, yes. But Joe Berrios losing. That's a very significant thing. And property taxes, I think, were just such a undercurrent in the race. And I mean, Chris Kennedy in the Democratic governor's contest. But Berrios' stories that the Tribune did with ProPublica about fairness of assessments, plus the fact that he said we're going to change things, and people asking, well, you've been there a while, how come you didn't change anything?
People hate paying property taxes, and we're told they're amongst the highest in the nation. So, and also the property tax system is so confusing that there are very few people who really understand how their property taxes are derived. So when they're told repeatedly and correctly, probably, that the game is rigged, they get mad, and Joe Berrios is the guy who's at the center of this. And it's if you look even a little bit at how he does things, the commercial stuff is even more hard to fathom than the residential stuff, because it's, you know, they're like throwing darts at a board and giving away discounts to the rich and powerful. But and I want to correct you a little bit, because you've struck a nerve here.
Okay.
The reporting on this was a Tribune story, assisted by two folks who work for me at the BGA now. ProPublica was a Johnny-come-lately.
Okay, well, all right. I'll let you have your say there, Mr. Sector. But Berrios, really, I think in some respects, he was like the Mike Madigan demonized person of that Rauner has done, but Berrios became the local, and of course Berrios being an ally of Madigan.
Yeah, I think, you know, in general, one of the things that this election showed, I mean, there was a couple of things. Number one, that money matters, but it's not everything. And this one also showed that organization matters, but it's not everything. I mean, Mike Madigan basically won all the districts that all the races he cared to win, and Dan Lipinski, again, another sort of establishment guy, he pulled it out in the end. And Pritzker, I think that's the story of Pritzker. I mean, he just had this whole state blanketed and won 98 counties, and nobody else was organized. So organization matters, but there's a point at which you're too damn toxic to even have that help you. And I think that was the problem with Joe Berrios. Like you say, everybody hates poverty. Not in Illinois. Everybody hates poverty taxes everywhere in the country. And that's because you pay them, you know, twice a year, a big chunk of money. It's one thing with the sales tax. It's a penny here. It's a nickel there. It's all hidden. Said property tax, here's a big bill for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. And nobody likes that. And then you layer on top of that this crazy I mean, it seems like a big shakedown racket, what they've got going on in this county, right?
Well,
you get
it
you get a bill, then you hire a lawyer who appeals it, and then you get your bill reduced, and the lawyer gets a piece of the action. I mean, you know, my old neighborhood, that's there's a name for that, and it's not property tax.
We're speaking to Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois, Bob Sector from the BGA. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're speaking with Bob Sector and Chris Mooney. We're talking right now about Cook County races. Tony Preckwinkle, 61%. Bob Fioretti, 39% in the Democratic primary for Cook County Board President. I thought this was an interesting race or county races for Preckwinkle. One coming off of the wildly unpopular and rescinded soda pop tax. At the same time, two of the people on the county board who were against the soda pop tax were defeated. So it would seem like, you know, here's Tony Preckwinkle would be ripe for a political challenge. There is no, as of now, there's no Republican on the ballot, although they would get to appoint one. But am I wrong of thinking that she was vulnerable, politically vulnerable?
Well, you would think so a few months ago, but that it shows how short people's attention spans are, I guess. But it also is a testament to the quality of the opposition. I mean, Bob Fioretti is getting to be sort of a perennial candidate, and he's never
ran for mayor before.
And he's, you know, he's not exactly a fireball on the stump, and doesn't have a lot of organization, and doesn't have that much money behind him. So, you know, if she had had a more formidable opponent, she might not have done as well. But, you know, you don't get to pick your opponents, but sometimes you luck out and get a weak one.
Well, and sometimes, I mean, it's a cause and effect issue here, too, right? Why did she only get Bob Fioretti as a candidate instead of somebody who was, you know, maybe more formidable candidate? And I, you know, in some ways, I think that's because, and the comparison here, I'm getting a little over my head here, I think, but the comparison is with, you know, the previous president, Stroger, and then the tax problem. But I think the difference between Stroger and current situation is that Preckwinkle has a history of competence, a history of goodwill that she can call on when she makes a stumble, you know, whether it's the right or wrong thing. It was unpopular, this soda tax, and that, so you could call it a political stumble, and she was able to recover because she had you know, a background of support. And I think that's always, it's more, it's like when you're you know, you get the flu. If you're in good shape going in, okay, you can kind of deal with it. If you know, if not, you know, it might be the end.
Well, and with Preckwinkle, too, she has now announced that she is going to be seeking mm-hmm. the Cook County Democratic Party chairmanship that Joe Berrios is unlikely to retain. Mm-hmm. So that's going forward. We also, on the statewide ballot, Democratic contest, eight-way contest for Attorney General, Kwame Raoul wins that, 30.2% of the vote. To Pat Quinn's 27.4%. I would say that I was surprised because I just thought eight-way race overshadowed by the governor's race, people not familiar with some of these candidates, that here again, Pat Quinn name recognition, that'd be an automatic.
Now, perhaps there's a little bit of Pat Quinn fatigue.
Well, that's what I would attribute it to.
Yeah, and you know, we've just kind of had enough of him. And it doesn't make him a terrible person, but, you know, after you've run for every office in America, almost...
Not the comptroller.
No.
Not the comptroller.
Okay.
Which he's not ruling out at some point.
But, you know, and he was governor, and, you know, and he was governor for, what, 6 years, something mm-hmm. like that? And, you know, after a while, people say it's enough. Let's try somebody else.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with you, Rick. I mean, that the scenario, and you kind of felt like this was strategic on his part because he didn't come into the race until quite late,
right.
And there was a bunch of candidates in there. That hey, maybe
there's
I'll sneak
political
in here.
Opportunity.
That's there. Right. Maybe get a buy, you know, get a cheap shot here. He really almost didn't even have to run if he didn't want to because it was name recognition. But I think Raul had a couple of things going for him. Number one, he had the backing of the organization. So again, this is another situation in a primary where turnout is routinely low, even though it was higher than previous primaries. It's lower than in the general, and especially in the off-year elections. And so organization matters more. Plus, he was one of only two African-American candidates in the race, and his name, you know, Kwame Raoul, is one that stands out, and I think is as potentially an African American name, and so he, you know, and in the Democratic Party in the primary, the African American vote is still very, very important.
Although, you know, there was a time where a name like Kwame Raoul, people would just say, what the heck?
Yeah, but remember who's...
George Fangmeister. Remember, that was a foreign name at one point.
Yes, things change.
Well, and,
you know,
remember?
Yes.
Kwame Raoul's predecessor in the Senate was another funny name guy, too, named
right.
Barack Obama.
No, but so that sets up a race against Erica Harold, who won her primary handily. And Erica Harold, African-American woman, used her winnings from Miss America to finance her Harvard law degree, is conservative. Is it possible that voters might, even in a Democratic, potential Democratic wave, might pick a Republican for Attorney General after, you know, Lisa Madigan's lengthy tenure there?
Well,
no, go ahead.
I was going to say it seems highly unlikely, but you know, you never know. That's why that's why we run the election. Why we play the game. And you got 6 months. Maybe Raul will stumble. But I think it's his race to lose. And you know, so it seems unlikely. And especially because he's been around a while. He's been vet. He's not one of these neophyte guys like the Pritzker who you don't know what's going on. He's been sort of, even though he maybe had. I don't think he's had a lot of real tough races, but still, if there had been something in his closet, it would have come out by now, I think.
He has a record to vet, though, unlike Harold. And, and
that's true.
You know, one thing I just wanted an observation to make, which probably gets into our next segment in that next half hour, but if you look at the results, the winner of the Democratic race for Attorney General, a down-ballot race, actually got more votes than the governor of Illinois in his race. So,
ouch. Yes, we will be talking more about that. We're speaking with Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois' Institute of Government and Public Affairs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. My guests here in the Allstate Showcase studio, Bob Sector from the BGA and Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois. We've been kind of dissecting the results of the Tuesday primary. We're going to shift to the governor's race, and the governor's race for the fall began just as the primary race to determine the nominees ended. Republican Governor Rauner's team put out a video with the words of J.B. Pritzker's opponents.
J.B. Pritzker is Mike Madigan's candidate. Everyone knows it. It's clear. And if the Democratic Party wants to nominate Mike Madigan's candidate, they should nominate J.B. Pritzker.
I think J.B. Pritzker's emerged as the poster child for pay-to-play politics in this state.
It took J.B. Pritzker a week to get permission from Mike Madigan to even name him in talking about this sexual harassment cover-up.
Pritzker's really there to protect the status quo.
J.B. Pritzker is Mike Madigan's candidate.
So, naturally, Democratic nominee J.B. Pritzker's team decided to follow up with its own video ad using the words of Rauner's primary opponent, State Representative Jeannie Ives of Wheaton.
The base voters, the Republican voters, are not going to reelect Governor Rauner. We care about character. We care about principles, and he will not be elected in 2018.
He basically got nothing done. He did some crony corporate bailouts. He didn't run his agencies effectively. You've got this entire Quincy Veterans Home catastrophe.
What the hell is wrong with this governor?
You cannot buy back your trust after a betrayal, and that's where Governor Rauner sits.
Governor Rauner has failed the integrity test in many ways.
13 deaths, 11 lawsuits against the taxpayers of the state of Illinois for failure to perform to duty.
As treacherous and dishonest as he has been as governor, he has been worse as a candidate for governor.
And I really don't care to say anything to the governor at this point, quite frankly.
Nobody can trust Bruce Rauner. He's lied to everybody about everything.
So, we're off and running in the race for governor. let's start with the Republican side and Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. A 2 percentage point victory, 51% to 49%, by roughly less than 20,000 votes, which is less than 2 votes per precinct in the state of Illinois. We knew that there would be a protest vote, but this was like a protest wave. I thought I wouldn't be surprised if she had gotten into the 40% mm-hmm. mark. And I guess I wouldn't have necessarily been shocked had she won.
Yeah, I think generally you're going to see the right wing candidate in the Republican primary statewide is going to get 25-30% just against a moderate, middle of the road candidate, generically. That's what happened to Edgar when he ran in 94 against Roser. So the difference between that 25-30% and 49%. That's either, because we're talking about percentages, it's either the moderates stayed home, and so the movement conservatives just made up a larger proportion of who actually voted, or a bunch of those people, the moderates, voted against Bruce Rauner in favor of a candidate who's significantly to the right, probably of where they stand on most issues, and that undoubtedly has to come down to the performance of Bruce Rauner,
which is a little bit of a reflection of not so much in Illinois, but how Trump got elected. I mean, there probably were a lot of moderate Republicans, mm-hmm. if they still exist, who wanted to cast a protest vote, and they did.
Well, and so you have Ives winning 38 counties at least. DuPage, Keene, right. Will, McHenry, Kendall. Rauner wins Sangamon County by fewer than 1,100 votes, and Lake County, ostensibly his home county, by about 1,200 votes.
Yeah, it's a big message. I mean, he got whacked, and by a candidate who spent, in the end, according to the Illinois Campaign for Political Reforms analysis, Bruce Rauner spent $214 per vote. Jeannie Ives spent $12 per vote. That's an incredible difference in efficiency.
So how do you, if you're Bruce Rauner, how do you move forward here? You have to try to find a way to unify the party and your base, and then you grow from the base. But the divide's very deep.
He's got a real problem, partly because he's tried to play both sides, and especially with the passionate conservative voters, they don't want to play both sides. They want purity, and he does not exhibit that. He's also doesn't seem to be. He won last time because he was able to convince moderates in the suburbs that he had no social agenda. Remember that? That was his, that was one of his talking points. Well, now he does have a social agenda, apparently. And, you know, I don't know how he gets them back in November.
Well, and, I mean, ostensibly, and what Jeannie Ives says that put her into the race was the signing of known as HB 40, which was the bill to expand taxpayer-funded abortions for poor women and women covered by state employee health insurance. And ostensibly his signature on that might be something viewed positively by those moderate suburban women that we talk about. But then, just weeks ago, he vetoes a bill that would require the state licensing of gun dealers, which would seem to run counter to trying to reach out to moderate suburban Republican women, many of them moms with kids in schools.
And you know what his answer to all that is it's Mike Madigan's fault. I mean, it really is. It's interesting. Ever since he was a candidate the first time, his whole campaign has been about Mike Madigan is horrible, terrible. He's the reason he's responsible for every ill in Illinois and probably many we haven't even thought of. And, you know, and what's happened to Bruce Rauner is that Mike Madigan has run circles around him strategically and put him in the boxes, you know, helped pass that HB 40, which put Rauner in a trick bag, passed the gun bill, which put Rauner in a trick bag. And you know, for a guy who is going to do away with Mike Madigan, it looks more like Mike Madigan's done away with him. Now, Mike may be going away, too, at some point, because he's got his own problems, but Rauner has not bested Mike. Matter of fact, he's not in charge. Madigan's in charge, remember?
Well, and I've actually thought that if we could trademark in the name Mike Madigan and tax it, so that the governor could bail out the state on his own.
There you go. Yeah, he's got the money to do it.
Yeah, but he's, you know, it's interesting. Is he going to continue this right through November? Is that going to be his one theme? Mike Madigan, Mike Madigan, Mike Madigan? That's not a winning issue for him.
Yeah, I don't see anything else he's got. I mean, re-election campaign, especially for chief executive, is all about the incumbent.
It's a referendum on the incumbent.
Exactly.
And but he's trying to shift it into a referendum on Mike Madigan.
Right, which, you know, yeah, he's going to, what else has he got, right? He's got to try, right? Mostly incumbents run and they say, I did this, I did that, look, you know, vote for me and I'll set you free kind of thing. But he doesn't have much to show for it, and so he has got to run as outside. Like he did last time, saying, I'm going to break the system. The system's terrible. I couldn't do it in the last 4 years, but I tell you, this time for sure, you let me in there, I'll get it done.
That's Chris Mooney, political scientist at the U of I. We've also got Bob Sector from the BGA here in studio. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on historic North Michigan Avenue. I'm speaking with Bob Sector, Director of Investigations from the Better Government Association, and Christopher Mooney from the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. We've been talking about all of the races. It's time now to close out with the Democratic race for governor. J.B. Pritzker, winning with 45% of the vote. Chris Kennedy finishing third at 24%. Daniel Bismuth 27% in second place. I guess what I was surprised at was the totality of Pritzker's victory. Wins 98 of 102 counties. Biss won Champaign and McLean counties, two college communities. Chris Kennedy won Ford and Hardin County.
Ford County, that's a hotbed of liberalism. Actually, I think Alan Keyes won that county, as I recall, in 2001.
No, but Pritzker's numbers were consistent throughout the state. Mm-hmm. And from the city, the city breakdown was basically mirrored the state breakdown, which you don't often find in a highly competitive primary. Surprised?
Well, it shows you a little bit what happened 4 years ago too. Money talks, and you know the airwaves were saturated with J.B. Pritzker ads.
$33 million.
Yeah, and so I bet you a lot of those voters, had never, if they had heard of the others, they didn't know anything about them. All they know is that there's this rather chubby, nice man on TV. Whose name they've kind of vaguely heard because the Pritzker, if you go to Chicago, the Pritzker name is everywhere. And, that's about the level of sophistication a lot of voting is.
Yeah, and also it seems to me from the outside that the Pritzker ran, he had a lot of money. Lots of people have a lot of money, and lots of people have a lot of money and blow it, right? Look at Bruce Rauner. He won, but he spent a lot of money and didn't really do very well. But Pritzker had both money and, it seemed to me, smart campaigning. I mean, they got out early. They did the ads they needed to do. They sort of responded to their opponents in very titrated way to kind of, knock them down. It started coming up a little bit, keep them down, but don't get them down too far, because if they would have gotten, if he had a run against one person head on head, it would have been a much more difficult fight for him. And he kept them in. He had organization all the way throughout the state, won big down state, sort of the Rob Blagojevich approach, and, just put it all together, found a very strong lieutenant governor candidate who was very effective, and I think we're going to hear more from her than we do from most lieutenant governors if they win.
Yeah, it was interesting. She gave a very strong and impassioned speech on Tuesday night when they were declaring victory.
Juliana Stratton.
And Rauner, who was introduced by his lieutenant governor, Evelyn Sanguinetti, did not even acknowledge her in his victory speech. It was quite amazing.
Well, and I thought, frankly, Juliana Stratton's speech was kind of a foretelling of her role in the campaign, because it was very much a attack on Bruce Rauner right from the get go there, and she being a first term. State representative from Chicago. Chris Kennedy, I was surprised at, because I think, and everybody goes into Election Day kind of hearing stories, and that if there's a large undecided vote, it would go to the Kennedy name because of the Kennedy DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would think. I mean, if there, which ways are going to break? But it, obviously, it didn't. I mean, proportionally, this is exactly the sort of numbers we've been seeing for months, that Pritzker's basically doubles the other two, and that's what we saw in the final.
Well, what I was surprised too with Kennedy was in going through the majority African American wards in the city of mm-hmm. Chicago, because that was Kennedy's kind of key, was getting support in the African American community, where he basically was in the low 20s.
Right. Pritzker won all the African American.
Look, in many of them, not all of them, actually.
No,
but Pritzker got over 60% of the vote in most of them.
Yeah.
I mean, so it was even a more domination than what you saw in the statewide.
Look, Illinois is not Massachusetts. And Camelot was 50 years ago. So I never
like
understood.
60 almost.
60, yeah.
Well,
and quite frankly, that was always my question going into this, is that as much as Chris Kennedy had been encouraged by others and other publications to jump into any race about bringing back Camelot, whether that name had kind of generationed out. And I think perhaps, in some respects, we have an answer.
Well, and he had nothing else to offer, really. I mean, for example, his ads were all about, my uncle was this, and my father was that, and, that and a couple, $2 will get you a cup of coffee, right?
This is short attention span theater, and you're trying to appeal to people with a nostalgia ad that they don't even know about.
That's Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association. Also, thank you to Chris Mooney, political scientist at the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs.